From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. We're in an unusual spot to record the show this week at the London Hotel. So my guest is director Steve McQueen, who was first here with his film Hunger, which won the Camera D'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. His new film is Shame. Steve, thanks for being back. It seems like you're trying to go sideways through all the seven deadly sins in these films.
Thank you for inviting me again on your show. Backwards, sideways, upside down. I don't know. It's just they come as they come. You know, you have the cars and you turn them over. Oh, okay, that's what I have to do next. So it's been those. Yeah.
But it feels like so much that pride is a part of this movie in some weird way. You know, misplaced pride and sorrow.
Well, I think the sorrow is key. I think there's this element of time with sorrow, isn't there? And I think, of course, with Brandon, played by Michael Fassbender, it's in him from the get-go. We all carry a lot of luggage with us in our lives. All stories, scars, things which happen to us. I mean, we're all like magnets. Things stick to us from our past. And of course, what we carry, what we want to sort of carry with us, that sort of appears in our present as such.
I mean, there's a kind of interesting, I ran to not long ago when I saw Shame, I found myself thinking of Bear, just because that ambiguity and that piece Bear where the two men are looking at each other and it's both kind of maybe combative and flirtatious. And I thought of that when I was watching Shame.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, God, you're going straight for the hard questions here.
So let me do this. Let me ask you to explain to the audience what the movie's about.
It starts with Brandon, who is a relatively successful, attractive young man. You know, he's doing his daily thing, his regular day-to-day office routine. But he has a certain kind of nocturnal activity which sort of spills over into his daily life, which is he has a wanting for sex, but very often. And his sister comes to stay with him unexpectedly, Sissy, and disrupts the sort of routine he has.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Steve McQueen, whose new film is Shame. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. It's funny, though, that this film could also have been called Hunger, because certainly appetites play a part in this movie, don't they?
Yeah, need, desire, passion, a sort of trying to get some kind of fulfillment in a way, some kind of satisfaction. We're starting with the abstract, which is very awkward, very interesting, because in some ways this is exactly where I want to get to in the film. And it's just one of those things, with this character, Brandon, is trying somehow to console himself with sexual activity in a way that sort of helps him sort of deal with the sorrow. You know, deal, and it lulls him in some ways. It makes it okay. It makes it better. And of course, like a baby's, when you start to cry, you have to lull it again. So it's a circle. It's one of those things which is sort of he goes on these sexcapades and he comes out of it and he feels shame and he goes back into it again.
One of the things that's kind of fascinating about the way you make films, and I think you sort of bring the perquisites of art in the way you use space. Space is key. The way people inhabit space is key in both in Hunger and in Shame, is it not?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think that's a great point. I mean, I think with Hunger, firstly, we were dealing with the Mays prison. And, you know, this prison was designed by the Germans to house the Bayern Munich. And then this building has been transported over to Northern Ireland to house sort of these so-called terrorists of the time, the maximum security prison. And within this prison are these cells, and these cells are no bigger than, I don't know, I mean, in feet, 10 feet by, say, 6 feet. And therefore, within that, we have the camera, and that dictates to us how we shoot. That limitation, in fact, is actually freedom. But also within that, you have the regime, you have the formality of the regime, the ritual of what happens in a prison cell, because it's pretty much like clockwork, what happens there every day. But the inmates are the ones that sort of have a certain sense of trying to sort of break the routine, of course. As we have in Shame, you have a situation where, just Brandon, a guy relatively well off, has this apartment. It's a small apartment, but it's quite an expensive one. Within that small space, he has his own sort of world as such. He's his own ritual, which he gets up to. But what happens, of course, is what happens is to disrupt this ritual, disrupt this formality, in comes Sissy, his sister, unexpectedly. And that's where the sort of the jux of the story starts.
And she is quite disruptive. I mean, I thought, as I mentioned to you, this apartment is being almost like a warren rather than a real apartment. And as soon as she comes into it, she disrupts this very carefully plotted out world he has. That's what thing you're talking about. She completely throws it off just by her presence in that small space with him.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, her clothes scattered over the place, and Banner's very particular in a way, it's slightly anal, record collection, you know, and so forth and whatnot. And Sissy comes, sleeps on the couch, throws her pants and whatever all over the place. There's a certain kind of the opposite of the two people. I mean, in some ways, Brandon's imploding and she's exploding. Hence the whole idea of her being this extrovert character. Hence the whole idea for me that she was a singer, a performer. So these sort of logical sort of explanations sort of come out in who and what they are and how they behave.
And it's interesting, too, because two of the key scenes that really spotlight that sort of disruptiveness that she has in the place are two scenes in the bathroom where he walks in on her and she walks in on him. We get a chance to see how really she's thrown his place off.
Intimacy has been sort of, intimacy, that privacy, I would say, has been sort of intruded on.
It's the treat. My guest is Steve McQueen, director of course, Hunger, and his new film is Shame. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. But I'm really fascinated by the way you tended to use space anyway, and coming to America, coming to New York.
Flick Eddie Murphy.
That's right. He's sexual chocolate, Steve McQueen. But it's fascinating just to see how Brandon is kind of like a trapped animal in New York.
It's interesting. I mean, again, the intention was not to make this movie in New York. It was to make it in London. But unfortunately, no one would talk to us in London about sexual addiction.
Really? Is that true?
No one would talk to us in London. So what happened that we came over to talk to two experts in the field who happened to be in New York. They actually introduced some people who were sex addicts, and therefore from that we decided to sort of, you know, I said, why not shoot it in New York? And that was it. It was just because of that. But what I wanted to have was that authority in some ways to make a film in New York. And in order to have the authority, one had to know Brandon, where he lived, where he went to work, where he'd get his food from, where he'll get his clothes cleaned and so forth and whatnot. And the whole idea of this situation with this person, of course, we'll just have to sort of have no contact with really anyone apart from, you know, servicing his laundry, his food and whatnot. And you know, that was it. I mean, it was very, very, you could exist in New York in a way without actually meeting anyone apart from your work colleagues. And I just wanted to have that idea. So therefore, we had to really work on what he would be able to afford with his salary as apartment, where he would live, how he would travel to work, where he would work. I wanted to know everything. So therefore, when we shot, it had this kind of a certain kind of realism to it, really.
I find myself thinking about these correlations between loneliness that exists in your work as an artist and between, well, to go just use Hunger and Shame as examples, Hunger is often a film about people who made their peace with loneliness, who are like Bobby Sands, who's committed himself to this stuff. He knows who he's going to be. And Brandon is a victim of his loneliness.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? It's kind of weird. And also, with all the sort of human contact he has in a way, you know, physical or at work or whatever it is, he seems to be so still on his own. I'm not too sure why that is, really. I don't know. It's obviously to do with sort of how we live now, I suppose. You know, we have so many choices, but, you know, it seems that we're sort of obliterated by everything, and we can't seem to sort of grab on something which is sort of, more for a better word, I can't think of anything real, whatever can actually give us some real sort of satisfaction in some ways. I'm not too sure.
I mean, the closest he actually seems to come to satisfaction, Brandon, is when there's a scene when he's running and the music is playing. That's the closest he comes to a real act of climax, of consummation, isn't it?
Well, I think ritual, that kind of ritual, again, it's running, it's music. I mean, the reason why I chose Bach, particularly Glenn Gould playing Bach, the Goldberg variation, was because that I wanted Brandon to have this kind of mathematical equation within sound, which he could grab onto, solid. You know, that's the whole idea of him having that tangible relationship with music. Vinyl, his vinyl collection. It wasn't this source which came from an iPad or iPod or whatever it is, something which is out in the outer space. It was actually a tangible object, physical, and the whole idea of running. Again, this ritual, the body, you know, the body, using the body. It's like meditation for him, obviously, for him to sort of feel something, feel real or that he could hold on to something. in the eye of the storm as such, in the situation like him, like Sissy, you know, what happens in the movie, Sissy sleeps with his boss, and you'll see that, of course, hopefully.
Yes, if you see the movie, which is shame, my guess is of course, the director, Steve McQueen. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. It's The Treatment. But I just found that sense, that thing you're talking about. I mean, he's got records so he can play them, so he can touch them, so he can take them out and look at them. And there's that whole kind of sense of ritual about putting his hands on things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's to feel. That's the word I'm looking for, really. To feel whatever it is. So many things that numb you in our surroundings and in our daily life, you know, and don't have any real sort of depth or meaning. I think that's what he wants to have in order to feel. But it's very difficult because when he does get close to something that he can actually feel, like in the movie, there's a possibility of him getting close to this girl he meets in the office. He runs away from it.
The movie can seem kind of episodic, but each of these incidents drives the story forward. He has a kind of an incident with his sister, which drives him towards trying to make contact with this woman.
Yes.
I mean, and then we get a chance to see, and that's what I thought was kind of interesting about the film, too, that often in films about sex addicts, the protagonist is charming and somebody who can draw somebody to bed with him. And Brandon's not that guy. I mean, he's almost puppyish, cultish in these attempted courtship scenes. And there's interestingly, a kind of an innocence, a naivete comes through when he's trying to talk to her.
I'm not too sure what it is, that innocence is. I suppose it's difficult when you're talking about yourself for the first time. I mean, often it's the case, and you know, I get the impression that most people don't listen to anyone. You know, they don't pretend, well, they pretend to listen. People don't really listen. Often, these days, I mean, in a way, but when you do have the opportunity to speak about yourself in some ways, it seems to be in America, at least, it seems to be you're talking to a shrink. So it's very difficult to have those kind of conversations, I think, in someone, because you have to trust that person doesn't take advantage of what you're saying, or what you're giving them, really. You know, you're giving a part of yourself to that person.
Yes, and she's trying to give herself to him, at least to make herself vulnerable in the way that makes him uncomfortable because he doesn't want to be vulnerable. I mean, it's a fascinating thing to watch.
It's odd. It's odd. It's odd. It's very, I know. And again, he's sometimes he's too honest, of course, because he doesn't, the whole idea of him sort of trying to say about relationships and marriage and, you know, because he wants to deny it, even the possibility of it, even though there could be a possibility of it, even if anything happens, even. So he's waving red flag before, you know, the questions is actually even being asked, or the possibility has actually even occurred.
I mean, we're in that scene, we're really aware of that kind of loneliness where it's obvious he doesn't communicate with people very often, and he doesn't know what to say to her.
Well, in that way, no. And I think he, you know, communicates in other ways, of course, but within the whole idea of intimacy, no. Even his sister, I mean, my goodness, I mean, the only time he actually listens to his sister, Sissy, in the whole movie is when he's forced to. And he's forced to because he brings his boss, David, to this nightclub to hear his sister sing. And in the process of that, he can't leave. He can't move. He's trapped. And then within that situation, Sissy sings. She sings to him directly. And within that, you know, his guard, it evaporates. It's sort of the scaffolding sort of crumbles. The drawbridge opens and his heart is exposed, and you see what happens when that happens. What happens is that he's totally taken in by it, and he's moved emotionally. And of course, once that moment has sort of finished, the drawbridge has gone up, the scaffolding is sort of propped up around, and his guard is up. He's closed again.
It's The Treatment. My guest is director Steve McQueen. His new film as director is Shame. We'll take a break. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
I'm Jenny Radelet, producer of The Treatment. If you like this program, check out other podcasts from KCRW, including Bookworm, The Business, DNA, Unfictional, and Good Food. They're on iTunes or on KCRW's smartphone apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm not a shrink. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. My guest is director and co-writer of the films Hunger and his new film Shame, Steve McQueen. You've chosen in Fassbender somebody who in Hunger is furiously verbal, who is able to use words as both a cudgel and a way to bring people out. And in Shame, somebody who is so uncomfortable with speaking, unless it's transactional. Talk to me about getting somebody who can who does those things.
So if you, that's a great question. That's a great question. That's interesting. So it's a bit of a eureka moment for me, because that's exactly it. Bobby Sands, for example, Nanga, he's all about speech, because before the speech, what happens is violence. And when you exhaust violence to its ultimate exhaustion, you know, you start to talk. And then you exhaust speaking to this ultimate, you know, until you get to your jaws start to hurt and whatever, and then you go back to violence again. So the situation with Bobby Sands, he's in a prison cell, so he, you know, maybe the violence on his body, his own body himself, that's another thing, that's another extreme. But yes, Bobby Sands and Michael was a very verbal, very articulate person, of course, you know, spilling words out and pushing language to its absolute limit, having to, because you push violence to its limit. You have to push words to its limit. So now, you're quite right, with Brandon, he doesn't speak that much. And I wanted that come with that Valentino movie star thing, because in some ways, most people don't actually, you know, speak. You know, most guys, but I'm trying to say situations where people don't really speak, particularly Brandon won't speak about his private life with other people. It just wouldn't happen. And I was thinking about this. I was thinking about this. Myself and Abby were talking about this character.
And with the co-writer, Abby Morgan.
And with the co-writer, Abby Morgan, who's fantastic. We're talking about this. Brandon just wouldn't, you know, would he go to shrink? No. Who would he speak to? No. Well, he wouldn't. He just wouldn't. But we have to see it. We have to see the past in the present through other means. So talking about the past is nonsense. It just wouldn't happen. So how do you deal with that within the structure of a film, a movie, how you present it to the audience, which is recognizable to them and real to them? So that's what we worked on, really. That's what we worked on. I think it's interesting that you said that about the two characters, and also Michael playing those two characters. I mean, Michael's extremely physical. He's a very physical actor, extraordinarily beautiful physical actor, but also extraordinarily articulate, beautiful, lyrical, verbal actor too. So he could play with the two things in a wonderful way.
I just find it fascinating,
very,
just because he seems almost mask-like in this. Mm. And you could see the play of thought in Bobby Sands, and it really is a paroxysm of words. I mean, the words were exploding. I mean, there's this constant kind of violence even going off in his head. And he ruled by, you could see he was a tribal leader in that scene with the father. When they're talking.
Liam Cunningham.
Yes. Mm. You can see that he was, by natural right, a leader.
Yeah.
And it was almost like he was a king speaking to his priest. And it was a fascinating exchange to watch, this how he took control there. And here he has no control, right down to not even knowing how to sort of get words out. And I just thought the most astonishing scene of any of your movies is the scene where he and Sissy and his boss are all in the cab together.
Yeah,
it's powerful and awful, just that sense of how space is confining one person and completely liberating for two other people.
Very good. Great piece. And also the fact that there's a reflection in the car, showing you have the sort of you know, the excess and the access and everything, you know, lights and stars and stuff. Brandon's looking out the window trying to avoid kissing.
I'm just drawn to that scene in Shame. I mean, it's a visual representation. It could be a piece, an installation at the Tate that just repeats, you know, and you could just watch it over and over again. It just takes so much from it. It almost feels as if you conceived it in that way.
Well, space, yeah. I mean, the subway, again, is another thing. You know, again, those moments, there's beautiful moments in subways where things happen. You know, a lot of things happen in New York. There's this beautiful grid system. You bump into people. That's why I put the girl back on the... Oops, if you haven't seen the movie yet, close your ears. Well, the lady comes back again on the train, and when the seduction lady, because that would happen. You're going to work every day. You often meet the same people on the train. So it wasn't a weird thing to do. Everything had to make sense. Everything had to be logical, just like the man not speaking and so forth. Everything had to be real, and why. So therefore, the structure is very, very important. And yeah, it's wonderful to film in New York, I imagine, because so many things, because of the grid system, you know, taxi cabs, metro, buildings, everyone lives. Also, a lot of people live in the air and work in the air. That's crazy. I mean, for me, of course, you know, as a person from London, you're a European person, it's like people live and work in the sky. Strange. And that perspective on the world as well, you're looking out the window, how does that reflect on you? It must make you feel, I don't know, very insignificant in some ways, or very significant in depending what side of the world you live in, half full or half empty. It's kind of strange, interesting how that the perspective of the world, how you have it. These things play a huge part, and it's interesting to see. I wasn't thinking that, of course, when I was making the movie. I mean, but I had the idea of it. But it's an interesting place to make movies. Very interesting place to make movies. I mean, I suppose it is a very common place to make movies.
But it's the treatment. My guest is Steve McQueen. We're talking about the uncommon way he's making movies. His new film as director is Shame, which I find myself thinking about that, too, that way that windows are used. Just got to remember being with you in the hotel, looking out over that on that kind of that same landscape on the Lower West Side, the meatpacking district that's used in one of those scenes. And what you were saying that night, just about you, a lot of these things you're saying now, you were saying then about significance and insignificance, and just about being away from the earth and what that does to you psychologically.
Yeah, I think it must do something. I mean, it does. It obviously does. I mean, interesting. I mean, glass, steel. The perspective. I mean, it's beautiful to look at, of course. But it's just, I mean, how we shot the office space, of course, with a lot of reflection. You see a lot of reflection. Obviously, a lot of people take that out. But I just love the idea of that sort of. Again, we use a wide screen to have the situation in the frame where you have two things in a frame. It's so wide, you'd have two things for to balance the frame. So two and two always, it's four, whatever. You always make a relationship with whatever else is in the frame. And but New York, it seems to sort of offer that up very, very easily. Very, very easily. I don't know. And the frame within the frame within the frame. And it's like Sissy seeing New York, New York. She's in the situation that she's framing her and Brandon's relationship, but then again, she's framing the outer world of New York and so forth and whatnot. So it's huge. It's kind of lots of double meanings.
Yeah, I felt that too, because I just sort of thought that the difference between the two of them really is romance. Finally, she wants it desperately, and he does not. I mean, that song, that moment when she's singing New York, New York, that's a big Byronic romantic kind of song, and she wants that, and she will brook the chaos it takes to try to find it if it's only for like a moment.
Absolutely. Simsim to Chic, the song music we use when Sissy puts on the record player when Brandon walks in, I Want Your Love. I mean, that song is as demanding as Sissy, I Want Your Love. And it's quite romantic, yes.
But those bells that go off are almost kind of like liturgical and like almost something you hear in the Catholic Church, those songs, those bells ringing in I Want Your Love, that chic sort of day.
Yeah, yeah, and they use it. You know, it's interesting, I heard that in Blondie's Rapture, he loved that song so much, the guitarist, I forgot they've got the guy's name in Blondie.
Nile Rodgers.
In Blondie.
Oh, Blondie. Oh, God. Yes, I know you're talking. Yes.
Yeah, forgive me. We forgot his name, but he's a genius person. He liked that record so much that he copied it. So it was almost like a copy. There's bells in Rapture as well. This is from Chic, I Want Your Love.
But I just found interesting, too, the way that, because there are women in this movie, and the way you sort of developed what women do for Brandon, what they really are fleshly in a way that he is not. I mean, they're sort of in touch with their bodies in terms of living in the world in a way that he is not, both his sister and the woman he courts at the office. I mean, they want to use their bodies for a different thing than he does.
Yeah, I think Sissy, I don't know what Sissy is very, she's looking for something so much. She wants something so much. She wants to sort of, those people, they just want to sort of, there's no compromising. There's no compromising. It's all or nothing, it's dangerous to be with people like that, because it's sort of, it's exciting for a while, but then it's just after a while, it sort of drags you down. I understand, in a way, that Brandon's sort of annoyance of Sissy. But Sissy is, I love Sissy because she is so much wanting to sort of, to live, really wanting to live in a way that she could sort of just be herself, to sort of feel, to touch, to taste, to express, to sort of, and in some ways she's a real artist in that way. She's a real artist, and unfortunately, it's something, often it doesn't pay very well to be an artist in life. Of course, Marianne is another person who's played by Nicole Beharie. I like Marianne. I think she's willing to sort of try. She's willing to sort of to try and make something out of something, which is maybe not a good thing to do. But she'll take a chance.
She's also the grown-up in the movie, yeah. You know? I mean, she's the one who represents looking for a future, which neither Brandon nor Sissy are capable of doing. They're both about the immediate. Mm. And I just sort of felt like that was an interesting sort of thing to make the one African-American woman in the movie, even the one person of color, the person who's looking for a future rather than just trying to find a momentary satisfaction. Even his boss is that kind of person who wants to be immediately gratified.
Well, that was interesting. I mean, I think it's interesting in the way that a lot of people saying to me when I came to America and I wanted to make cast this person, you know, because when I came to research the movie, all the people, apart from one guy, I think it was sort of, he was from somewhere in South America, were white, who were dealing with this sex addiction. I imagine, you know, because I suppose it's a different kind of, I don't know, there was a different kind of situation. I imagine if you went to other situations, you would find predominantly one other certain kind of ethnicity. But it's one of those things which is kind of fascinated me. But when we came to the workplace, it was as you see it. There was like one black person when we researched this thing. It was like, wow, it's kind of interesting. So, this girl could be, you know, this Brandon's girlfriend. But what was interesting about it was there was kind of an objections about it. They said, "Oh, that wouldn't happen. That wouldn't exist." I said, "Well, I don't exist." It was a very odd thing having these conversations about, you know, a love interest that was a black woman with Brandon. It was interesting that it was fascinating that. But then again, you know, what fascinates me is you have you have lots of sort of American filmmakers who, white filmmakers who never ever cast a black person ever in their movies, and they've made quite a few movies. It's always, how can you avoid that? It's kind of weird. I mean, it's almost like, you know, walking around with blindfolders on. I mean, how can you make movies in this country and consistently make movies and not cast black characters in the main leads? I mean, I've made two movies. The majority of people in my movies the feature films I've made, are white. I mean, my art films, you know, 99% of them are black. I mean, you know, I don't see that there's no distinguishing the two. It's, for me, it's just one thing. It's not art or film, you know. I mean, you know, that's how it is.
I waited 15 years for Marty to say that, and now we're out of time. Thanks so much for being here, Steve.
Pleasure.
My guest is Steve McQueen, whose new film, as directed...
Am I in trouble?
No! Neither of us in trouble. I hope so. Well, if this is trouble, I want more of it. His new film, as director, is Shame. Our recording engineer at the London Hotel in West Hollywood is Dario Moroni. The associate producer is Jenny Radulet. The show is edited and mixed by J.C. Swadek. From one black person to another, I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.